Good morning, children of the infinite, beloved of God. Let us go within the heart center, and feel there that there is a light that is glowing and growing as it expands and fills out your entire body, that every cell in your body is a tiny little solar system, glowing with a radiance. And that radiance goes out and fills your auric field, that electromagnetic field all around you. And it has a soothing, comforting, enlivening, and intelligence that radiates throughout your being. And then to go on expanding that sphere and see it going out and out and filling up the room that you're in and all the people in it. To go on expanding out to all the community in which you live, blessing all those that dwell therein. Continue expanding that orb until it goes out and encompasses this entire world. And see this world nestled in the bosom of this light, that it is not foreign or alien or strange, but that it is close, it is intimate, that every cell of this world is a cell of your own body, that you feel a warm intimacy with the spirit that pervades everything that is and all who walk upon it. And then go on expanding that circle and seeing it go out into the solar system, to this galaxy, until it encompasses this entire universe and all the millions and billions of galaxies that are within this universe. And then to see this universe as but an island of many island universes. And all of it is pervaded with that same warm intimacy, that warm light, that love. And then to see the vast astral spheres illumined like a large, brilliant balloon that is above the little basket of physical universes. And that you are more than that, even. You are vast beyond, and you expand out into the beyond, going to that infinite space where there is no time, no space. There is no distinction, no image that separates one thing from another, but is pure spirit, pure peace, pure silence of your own being. It is the stillness of God. And that God is both stillness and activity. He is both the uncreated and the created. That time and space are his creations, but he delights in his creations. And he takes great interest in every element, every aspect. There is no corner of this world or of the universe that is without the divine presence. and that in your heart center you may experience this oneness, this life, this joy that resonates throughout creation. And you are that. Reading from The Science of Religion by Paramahansa Yogananda, Chapter 2. First, we must know what religion is. Then only can we judge whether it is necessary for all of us to be religious. Without necessity, there is no action. Every action of ours has an end of its own for which we perform it. People of the world act variously to accomplish various ends. There is a multiplicity of ends determining the actions of men in the world. But is there any common and universal end of all these actions, of all the people, of all the world? Is there any common highest necessity for which all of us, which prompts us to actions? A little analysis of the motives and ends of men's actions in the world shows that though there are 1,001 proximate or immediate ends of men in regard to particular calling or profession which they take up, the ultimate end, which all other ends merely subserve, is the avoidance of pain and want and the attainment of permanent bliss. Whether we can at all permanently avoid pain and want and obtain bliss is a separate question. But as a matter of fact, in all of our actions, we obviously try to avoid the former and reach the latter. Why does a man serve as an apprentice? Because he wishes to become an expert in a certain business. Why does he engage in that particular business? Because money can be earned therein. Why should money be earned at all? Because it will satisfy personal and family wants. Why must wants be fulfilled? Because pain will thereby be removed and bliss be gained. As a matter of fact, happiness and bliss are not the same thing. We all aim at bliss, but through a great blunder we imagine pleasure and happiness to be bliss. How that has come to be so will be shown presently. The ultimate motive is really bliss, which we feel inwardly, but happiness or pleasure has taken its place through our misunderstanding, and the latter has come to be regarded as the ultimate motive. Thus we see that the fulfillment of some want, removal of some pain, physical or mental, from the slightest to the acutest, and the attainment of bliss form our ultimate end. We cannot question further why bliss is to be gained, for no answer can be given. This is our ultimate end, no matter what we do. Enter a business, earn money, seek friends, write books, acquire knowledge, rule kingdoms, donate millions, explore countries, look for fame, help the needy, become philanthropists, or embrace martyrdom. And it will be shown that seeking God becomes a real fact to us when that end is kept rigorously in view. Millions may be the steps, myriads may be the intermediate acts and motives, but the ultimate motive is always the same, the attainment of permanent bliss, even though it be through a long chain of actions. Man likes to and has to go along the chain to get to the final end. He may commit suicide to end some pain, or perpetrate murder to get rid of some form of want or pain, or some cruel heart thrust, thinking he will thereby attain a real satisfaction or relief, which he mistakes for bliss. But the point to notice is here too, is the same working, though wrongly, toward the ultimate end. Someone may say, I don't care anything about pleasure or happiness. I live life to accomplish something, to achieve success. Another says, I want to do good in the world. I don't care whether I am in pain or not. But if you look into the minds of these people, you will find that there is the same working toward the goal of happiness. Does the first want success that has in its achievement no pleasure or happiness? Does the second want to do good to others, yet himself get no happiness in doing it? Obviously not. They may not mind 1,001 physical pains or mental sufferings inflicted by others, or arising out of situations incidental to the pursuit of success, or the doing of good to others. But because the one finds great satisfaction in success, and the other intensely enjoys the happiness of doing good to others, the former seeks success and the latter others good, in spite of the incidental troubles. Even the most altruistic motive and the sincerest intention of advancing the good of humanity for its own sake have sprung from the basic urge for a chastened personal happiness, approaching bliss. But it is not the happiness of a narrow self-seeker. It is the happiness of a broad seeker of that pure self that is in you and me and all. This happiness is bliss, a little alloyed. So with pure bliss as a personal motive for altruistic actions, the altruist is not laying himself open to the charge of narrow selfishness, for one cannot himself have pure bliss unless he is broad enough to wish and seek it for others too. That is a universal law. So if the motives for all actions of all men are traced further and further back, the ultimate motive will be found to be the same with all, the removal of pain and the attainment of bliss. This end being universal, it must be looked upon as the most necessary one. And what is universal and most necessary for man is, of course, religion to him. Hence, religion necessarily consists in the permanent removal of pain and the realization of bliss or God. And the actions which we must adopt for the permanent avoidance of pain and the realization of God or bliss are called religious. If we understand religion in this way, then its universality becomes obvious. For no one can deny that he wants to avoid pain permanently and attain permanent bliss. This must be universally admitted, since none can gainsay its truth. Man's very existence is bound up with it. All want to live because they love religion. All want to live because they love religion. Even if a man committed suicide, it would be because he loved religion too. For by doing so, he thinks he will attain a happier state than what he finds living. At any rate, he thinks he will be rid of some pain that is bothering him. In this case, his religion is crude. But it is religion just the same. His goal is perfectly right, the same that all persons have. For all of them want to attain happiness or bliss. But his means are ridiculous. I think this is absolutely true, what Master is writing about here, and I know in working with many individuals who have had long-term depression and thoughts of suicide, that it is a very calculated thought and act to take one's own life. And the idea that one is in pain, and when the body is gone through suicide, then pain will be gone. And when I ask in those situations, what if that's not true? What if you take this life and you find that life continues and that you've actually made things worse rather than better? And that the pain continues? And they say, oh, well, I don't want that. So the idea that they think they're going to remove pain, and by virtue of that, that they will get the big rest that people think about with death, that finally there will be a cessation of breath, and with the cessation of breath, there will be a cessation of pain and sorrow. And with that will come bliss of a sort, whether it's conceived consciously or not. So this is absolutely true, what Master is saying. Because of his ignorance, he does not know what will bring him to bliss, the goal of happiness. Thus, in one sense, everyone in this world is religious, inasmuch as everyone is trying to get rid of want and pain and gain bliss. Everyone is working for the same goal. But in a strict sense, only a few in the world are religious, for only a few in the world, though they have the same goal as others, know that the most effective means for removing permanently all pain or want, physical, mental, or spiritual, and gaining true bliss. One must bid goodbye to the rigidly narrow orthodox conception of religion, though that conception is, in a remote way, connected with the conception I am bringing out. If for some time you do not go to church or temple or attend any of its ceremonies or forms, even though acting religiously in your daily life, by being calm, poised, concentrated, charitable, squeezing happiness from the most trying situations, then ordinary people of a pronounced orthodox or narrow bent will nod their heads and declare that, although you are trying to be good, still from the point of view of religion, or in the eyes of God, you are falling off, as you did not of late enter the precincts of the holy places. While, of course, there cannot be any valid excuse for permanently keeping away from such holy places, there cannot, on the other hand, be any legitimate reason for one's being considered more religious for attending church, if at the same time one neglects to apply in daily life the principles which religion upholds vis-a-vis those things that ultimately make for attainment of permanent bliss. Religion is not dovetailed with the pews of the church, nor is it bound up with ceremonies performed therein. If you have an attitude of reverence, if you live your life always with a view of bringing undisturbed bliss consciousness into it, then you will be just as religious out of church as in it. Of course, this should not be understood as an argument for forsaking the church, which is usually a real help in many ways. The point is that you should put forth just as much effort outside of the church hours to gain eternal happiness as you forgo while from the pews you are passively enjoying a good sermon. Not that listening is not a good thing. It is in its way, for it certainly is. The word religion is derived from Latin religare, to bind. What binds? Whom does it bind? And why? Leaving aside any orthodox explanation, it stands to reason that it is we who are bound. What binds us? Not chains or shackles, of course. Religion may be said to bind us by rules, laws, or injunctions only. And why? To make us slaves? To disallow us the birthright of free thinking or free actions? That is unreasonable. Just as religion must have sufficient motive, so its motive is binding us must also be good. What is that motive? The only rational answer we can give is that religion binds us by rules, laws, injunctions, in order that we may not degenerate, that we may not have pain, misery, suffering, bodily, mentally, or spiritually. Bodily and mental suffering we know, but what is spiritual suffering? To be in ignorance of the spirit. It is present always, though often unnoticed, in every limited creature, who, while bodily and mental pain come and go, what other motive of the word binding than the above can we ascribe to religion that is not either nonsensical or repelling? Obviously, other motives, if any, must be subservient to the one given. It is not the definition already given of religion consistent with the above-mentioned motive of the word binding, the root meaning of religion. We said that religion in part consists in the permanent avoidance of pain, misery, suffering. Now, religion cannot lie merely in getting rid of something such as pain, but it must also lie in getting hold of something else. It cannot be purely negative, but it must be positive too. How can we permanently get away from pain without holding to its opposite, bliss? Though bliss is not an exact antonym of pain, it is at any rate a positive consciousness to which we can cling in order to get away from pain. We cannot, of course, forever hang in the air of a neutral feeling. That is neither pain nor the reverse. I repeat that religion consists not only in the avoidance of pain and suffering, but also in the attainment of bliss or God. That bliss and God are synonymous in one sense will be explained later. By looking then into the motive of the root meaning of religion as binding, we arrive at the same definition of religion we reached by the analysis of man's motive for action. Religion is a question of fundamentals. If our fundamental motive is for seeking of bliss or happiness, if there be not a single act we do, not a single moment we live, that is not determined ultimately by the final motive, should we call this craving the most deep-seated one in human nature? And what can religion be if it is not somehow intertwined with the deepest-rooted craving of human nature? Religion, if it is to be anything that has value in life, must base itself on a life instinct or craving. This is an a priori plea for the conception of religion set forth in this book. And so we must admit what Master is saying here is true, that we are all ultimately seeking bliss in whatever form that we choose to find it in. And this leads to an article that I wrote for the latest Cross and Lotus Journal, that's a letter to a devotee. Dear devotee, you have talked to me about the legalization of marijuana, saying that it is not as harmful as alcohol, and making a case for its use. However, I cannot find within myself justification for its use. I will tell you why. In the field of addictions, there are certainly other drugs that are more powerful and addictive than marijuana. However, based on my own experience and many of those I have worked with around the use of cannabis, I can say the drug has octopus tendrils into the brain and nervous system that are not easy to remove. The lungs are the fastest route to the brain. Addiction is generally measured by how high a drug makes you and how quickly the effect drops off. Cigarette smoke gets nicotine to the brain very quickly. The high is not very high, but the drop-off is very quick. Some say it is habit-forming, not addictive. However, as millions of people who have repeatedly tried to quit smoking and have failed will testify, it is extremely habit-forming and difficult to stop its use. Whether a substance is addictive or habit-forming can be just a game of semantics. Such grammatical distinctions make little difference to the user trying to quit. My own experience with marijuana many years ago here is instructive. Mother asked me to quit its use. I tried quitting a couple times but failed. For me, marijuana was much harder to stop than alcohol. And that's an interesting time, that is early on in meeting Mother. And we never spoke about anything about my habits outside of church or anything, but one time after she gave a talk, and as I lined up to give her a hug afterwards, when I came up to her, she gave me a hug, and then she looked at me with full attention in her eyes, and she shook her finger at me, and she said, Now, no smoking and no drinking. And I rather embarrassedly said, yes, Mother, I know. So off I went and got around some old company, and company that we keep is so important, particularly when we are trying to overcome habits and we are newer on the path. And so I fell into some old habits again. And so sometime later, after a talk that she gave, she looked at me again and she said, no smoking and no drinking. And I think only because I never drank with my father, but I asked, what if my father should offer me a drink on New Year's Eve? Thinking that maybe I might have a little leverage with her, and it had absolutely none, of course. And she said, you can either have sociability or you can have Christ consciousness. You decide. And she moved me on. And so I had to decide. And I made a determination in myself that I must get rid of these things if I wanted to have Christ consciousness, you know, because you're working with the nervous system. And if on the one hand, you're purifying the nervous system through Kriya Yoga and deepened meditation, and on the other hand, you're deadening it and putting it to sleep, or you're over-stimulating it through the use of drugs, then you're giving with one hand, but you're taking away with the other, and you won't make any progress whatsoever. So I go on here with the writing. The last time I used it, the drug entered my lungs, and being sensitized from deepened meditation, I could feel its effect in the spine. It started at the base of my spine, sedating it and giving the sense of a relaxed euphoria as it made its way up the spine. The unique experience I had this time was the very definite feeling that this drug was a poison in my spine. And this poison was working its way into my body, circulating and entwining its way through my nervous system. It was sedating me, and it was making me dull to spiritual sensitivities. I never used the drug after that experience. But it was not easy to get it out of my system. I smelled it when it wasn't around. I felt the urge to use it. I could taste it at other times, even though I had not used it for some time. I really had to work at not using it again. When tempted, I would bring to mind the feeling of this drug being a poison, and in reality, it did not heighten spiritual sensibilities, it dulled them. I had been in a culture that actually held out drugs as a way to spiritual experience. While it is true a few had profound awakenings while using a drug, it is not possible for a drug to give you God. Perhaps because of a heightened or relaxed state of mind, a few people have triggered a true spiritual experience. However, drugs are like a powerful rocket, taking you up high, but you have no idea where you are going to land, and a significant number end their trip in a trash heap. When a drug is addictive or habit-forming, instead of giving you spiritual freedom, you are instead enslaved to its use. Even if you trigger a true spiritual experience when using a drug, it is not an earned experience. In other words, without real spiritual practice, you will not be a spiritual adept who can enter the same state through self-mastery. My own use with marijuana and other drugs proved to me that drugs are not capable of giving enlightenment. Quite the opposite. They take us further into delusion, and worse yet, become habit-forming and addictive. In our spiritual science, we know that the nervous system, the spine, and the brain are the lifeblood of a spiritually awakened being. Instead of putting the nervous system asleep or overstimulating it through drug use, we need to be about the work of spiritualizing our nervous system, making it stronger through meditation, chanting, and living an honest life, so that we might enter into true states of enlightenment. I have seen this issue from both sides, and I can tell you there is no relationship between drug use and experiencing self-realization. We all seek the bliss of knowing God. We as human beings look for that bliss in this world and through relationships, security through having money, aggrandizing the ego through positions of power or fame, pleasure through sexual satisfaction, and some through drug use or the bottom of the bottle. One thing that is true, we are told by all accomplished yogis that these ways of finding true happiness are false, delusive notions that will not lead to happiness, but greater ignorance. And this isn't just a battle that's being fought here in America. I remember reading about Swami Pranabananda, the tremendous yogi that Master wrote about, the saint with two bodies, and one of two saints other than the guru lineage that Master talked about that he met, who were fully realized, complete, having gone the whole way. But in his earlier years still, when he was meditating and having taken Kriya, he had gotten addicted to the Ganga or the marijuana of India. And he was smoking it on a regular basis, but he knew that he wasn't making spiritual progress and he felt miserable about it. And he really had to work at it. And one day he finally got a firm determination that he was going to kick this habit. And he stayed home from work and he stayed in bed for 3 days and he had a terrible time of it. But when he was done with it, he was done with it. And then when he would work, went back to work, and when he would come home, he would meditate for 8 hours that after work. And he got into the deepened states, and finally he got into, through all the experiences, and that he came into a fully realized state. But he would never have done it if he had stuck with the old habit. I have great appreciation for how hard it is to quit a pernicious habit. But I know that it can be done and that it has to be done if we are to attain anything of lasting value in this life. What is not helpful is to say that something that is wrong is right. I have known Kriyabans to quit their spiritual practice because smoking pot and drug use was more alluring, giving the false promise of lasting happiness. This is tragic. And this is true, that there have been those that, because they have valued smoking marijuana more highly than they have going to God and finding real bliss, you see, this identification, this definition for what a true religion is and a religious practice, the binding ourselves through a discipline, not to rob us of our free will, not to rob us of our happiness, but to help to discipline this mind to get rid of bad habits and things that run contrary to gaining God in order to fulfill what we have really come here for. And it is a poor bargain, I tell you. It is tragic. And there are others who, even after years of Kriya practice, have gotten caught up in other kinds of drug use, in cocaine and crack, and other kinds of drugs that have taken people away from the Kriya path, and it is indeed tragic. The truth is, we are here to free ourselves, and freedom is not gained by having license to do whatever we want, but it's gained by paying the pearl of great price to attain God realization. These are real consequences to drug use that not only affect your life, but the lives of those around you. Be wise, choose God, and enter into the kingdom of blissful freedom, the ever-new joy of the soul that you, in your heart of hearts, yearn to know. And so this notion that we bind ourselves, some people don't like that idea. And really, it's the ego mind inside of us. It thinks that if I do whatever it is that I want to do, that's real freedom. But when those choices lead us into habits and addictions that are not easily gotten out of, how can we call that freedom? We cannot. We must learn to identify and truly define what our spiritual practice is all about. As we go up the spinal stairway, we will meet every polarity, every duality within our being. The very things that we have put out during our previous existences will come back to us. Now, some things are not a problem to individuals. I remember when I was 6 years old and I was had watched my father smoke a couple of packs of Winston cigarettes every day, and I wondered what the deal was. Did these cigarettes, did they taste good? Why did he do such a thing? He's the only one in the family who did. So I gathered up my courage one day, and I remember standing next to his Lazy Boy chair as he is laying back smoking a cigarette, and I asked him if I could have one. And he said, well, sure. So he lit me up a cigarette, and he gave it to me, and he says, now take a nice deep breath out of this. And I was coughing and hacking, and he made me smoke that thing all the way down to the end of the filter. And I didn't get sick, but I never picked up a cigarette again. And even in my junior high and high school years, when most all my friends were smoking, I never even had a hankering to do it. I just didn't want it. And I think because, for one reason, it's not a habit that I had brought with me into this lifetime. It didn't have a hold on me. And I didn't keep going at it long enough until it had formed an addiction inside of my brain. And so I thank God for that, because I know people who have had a real struggle in order to get rid of such things. But if we worry about this planet, we worry about pollution, and we should be concerned about such things, just think what we do to our bodies. When we ingest drugs and we ingest nicotine and smoke and tar and all the rest of it, they come into our system. And we're polluting our bodies to a much higher degree and percentage than this world is getting polluted by a factory or anything else that's pumping these things out. So we must take personal responsibility. We must look after our health. We must do everything that's in our power to bring ourselves into a state of balance, to get rid of those things that form addictions inside of us. Master used to be very studious about anything that would start to get a hold on him. He talked about the one time that he started drinking coffee, of course, in India, he had never picked up that habit. But when he came to America, he started drinking coffee socially because other people did. And then one day he noticed that he was eating by himself and he was hankering after a coffee. And he said, enough of this. I don't want anything that has a hold on me. And he directly never drank coffee after that because he could feel its allure, he could feel its pull. Now, what if we did those things? Sometimes we just think, well, if something has a pull on us, then I just will give in to that, and I'll do more and more and more. I know that there are people who this last year, through the holiday seasons, that they swore off sugar for the season. Not that they had a lot before, but that they just thought they wouldn't even get started on that path because there's so much that's available. Any office that you go in, people bring goodies in and set them out for everybody to take. And pretty soon you're consuming more and more and more as you go through the season. And then there are illnesses that come about as a result of that. And you get sleepy and it has all kinds of problems. As you gain weight, your belt doesn't fit on the same notch anymore. And that becomes a problem as well. And so the one solution is just not even to start it and to avoid all of those things through the season. Now, as I say, what is difficult for one person is not difficult for somebody else. I've never had an attraction for chocolates. I enjoy a nice chocolate, a good quality chocolate every now and then. But I could really never care less whether I ever had one again. It doesn't have a hold on me. And for somebody else, it's a terrific challenge to try to get through life without overindulging in chocolate. And so we have to identify those things that are addictive or habit-forming. that take us out of balance, that create too much of a desire for something. Now, what is more difficult for me in many cases are potato chips, things like that for me. You just can't eat one, as the advertisement says. And so I have to be careful about what I eat around that way, because it's true, you just can't eat one. Can we get to that place where you could have a chip or a couple of chips and you're satisfied with that? And that's all right. And when you're in that place, then it's not a problem. But when anything ever takes hold of you, then we must exercise self-restraint. Self-mastery means that we can attune ourselves to divine consciousness and not be ruled by anything of worldly consciousness. If we have formed a habit of watching television or movies and it's just too much, and we can't do without it, suddenly we turn the television off and we feel like something's missing in our lives and we're just restless until we turn it back on again, then that has become a negative habit, because it robs us of our peace. It robs us of being conscious and in union with God. You see, so we must analyze things as we go along and find out where something doesn't have a hold on us. This is the real crime that we commit, is when we have things in our life that are more predominant than God. We must learn to put God first, and starting a new year is an excellent time to start new habits. Now, many people start with a good intention, but they don't keep it up. So we have to hold ourselves accountable. If you're going to make some good resolutions, then write them down and review them on a regular basis. And are you living up to these things? And don't just put it away and forget about it until the next year and say, oh yes, that's something that I'm going to attend to this year. We have a government right now that's in a runaway budget crisis. It's spending $1 trillion extra, more than what they're bringing in. And sometimes people do this on a personal basis. And it ruins people's happiness. It ruins your peace. It binds you in a negative way. It makes you a slave. And this is a terrible thing to have happen. So we must be conscious that we're not spending more than what we're making. If you have something that you would like to acquire, then create a fund for that. And that creates an intention of your desire, and then fill that fund with whatever extra money comes your way, or if you work extra overtime for that purpose, and you begin to fill that fund with that. And that creates a magnetism of attraction. Don't put it on the credit card. Don't run yourself into debt, but rather build a savings. And in this way, you can grow your economy into prosperity. And that as you have more prosperity, you will feel more of a keen attraction for accumulation in this way. Now, this is not negative. From a spiritual standpoint, unless that craving, that desire for money and seeing that bank account grows more than your thought about God, or if your all your trust and everything comes from having that bank account more than acknowledging and seeing that your real prosperity comes from God. Just think of having $1 million in the bank account, and knowing deep in your heart, deep in your soul, in your mind, you absolutely know for a fact that God is your prosperity, not that bank account. That's where all good things come from, that bank account can be wiped out, but that your peace will be the same. Master used to say, I don't care about possessions. Lord, only see to it that every day I have what I need. And imagine having complete and total faith in that, that God will provide for you whatever it is that you need on that day. and what freedom you would have. You would be able to walk this earth without being encumbered by a lot of things. Now, this is something that we can cultivate inwardly. We can still have a home, we can still have possessions, a car, and all the rest of it. But inwardly, we are free. If all of those things were taken away from us, we would not panic. We may not even grieve. It might even feel like a relief, you know, because all these things that we have, each one is a responsibility. We have to take care of it. We have to see to it in one way or another, even if it sits inert down in the basement. Nevertheless, it's something that requires something from us. And so when we get rid of these things, when we get rid of possessions and lighten the load, we feel freer. But you know, it's an interesting thing. We run up against some fear when that happens. We go to get rid of some things and we think, well, maybe I'll need this. And maybe I'll need that. And pretty soon, nothing's in the out pile. It's all in the in pile. And then we keep accumulating more and more. And really, if we were to ask ourselves, when was the last time I used it? And when will I use it again? When can I anticipate using again? And if the answer is that I haven't used it in a very long time, and I can't even think of when I'm going to be using it next, get rid of it. Lighten your load. You will feel more free. So this inward freedom, both from things of the body and possessions, this will give us greater freedom physically and mentally. And then we keep those relationships that nurture us. You know, this idea that one of the wise men brought myrrh and gave bitterness at the feet of the Christ. And you think, isn't that a strange thing to give the bitterness in life to Christ, to God? And yet it is absolutely necessary. Some people nurture a kind of bitterness in their life. Maybe they do things in life and they don't feel very appreciated for it. And they nurse a kind of bitterness about that, that, well, why don't people see everything that I'm doing and why aren't they helping me more? And they have no spirit of service. They don't have any freedom in it. They just get more and more bound up in this and tightened in it. And so social relationships, we need to see that they are freeing to us. Do we mix with kindred spirits? Do we look for people who have similar values to us? Do we do things for other people and then feel resentful afterwards? And question why others aren't doing. Why? What difference does it make? If God calls upon us to do a particular action, and we do that action, we should feel the fulfillment of that action in the doing. There's joy in that action. And whatever the result is from it, whatever anybody else's acknowledgement is around it, if something comes our way, if somebody says thank you, if somebody acknowledges what we've done, that just adds joy to the joy. But joy is already there. The fulfillment of that action is embedded in the action itself, because it is God who is expressing His life, His intelligence, His will through you. And when you are attuned to Him, you feel that. You feel God as blissful expression through you. And you can be the only one in the world who knows what you've done. And that is all right because God is with you. And God sees, and God expresses His joy, His fulfillment, His love through you. We must free ourselves from social relationships that otherwise would bind us and contain us and keep us in a state of ignorance. We must get serious about this. We must really examine ourselves. If we don't do it, we'll remain trapped in the same life we've always had. Now, this may bump along for a long time and you just make one excuse after another, but in the end, you will feel very disappointed in yourself. And you will think back, I wish I had listened to David. I wish I had really examined myself. I wish I had freed myself because now this lifetime is over with. And I've not done it. And I'm in the same trap. I'm in the same bind in a negative sense than when I was when I started this life. In fact, if anything, I've added fuel to the fire. And this desire nature has just grown and grown and ignorance has grown and I've not gotten anywhere. It's time to wake up. Change our lives. If you're not changing your life, you're just going to get more of the same. So this is important. And it's important that we listen and not only just listen, but do. To really begin to change our lives. Make a list of those things that you really want to improve upon. Narrow it down to a few things, because if you are scattershotting all over the place, you lose intensity. You lose, really, the power that's needed to break some of these kinds of habits. But really determine in yourself that you're going to change something in your life. A few things. You're going to deepen your meditation. You're going to get rid of the things that no longer serve you, whether they're habits of the body, whether they are pernicious habits of that kind, whether they're relationships, whether it's accumulation of stuff that we have that no longer serve us. We're going to get rid of these things. And we're going to change our lives. You know, it's an interesting feng shui principle, this kind of knowledge of how architecture and the things that we have either support us or keep us stuck. And there's a feng shui principle that if you want to change your life, then move 29 things that are in your possession. Move them around, shift their position. And when you do that, it helps to shift the energy. It gets things flowing, it gets things moving. So let's think about this. Let's organize our lives. Let's narrow it down to the things that we really use and move forward with our lives. And spiritually, let us get rid of the things that hold us back. And let us do more of those things that help us move forward. We have been given the most wonderful techniques mankind knows about. Through Kriya Yoga, through chanting, through meditation. But do we utilize it to the fullest? Do we really get in and do the work, make the effort? Or are we just coasting along? And if you're just coasting along, that's not good enough. You're just going to remain on the surface. And eventually you're going to tire of it because you're not getting new inspiration. You're not breaking through the old things that keep you held back spiritually. And as a result, you're not getting the truth. You're not getting the spiritual rebirth. You must prioritize your life and do it in such a way that you are moving through these things, conquering them. I just recently made a list of things that I'm moving forward with in this next year, and I thought, well, it'd be interesting, and I just went back and made a list from last year of all the things that changed and all the accomplishments and all the changes. And it felt good. It felt good. But it also heightened the urgency that there are some things that definitely needed to be tended to. Now, my life is not always my own in this sense. And that's not excuse making, but it makes me all the more determined to get these things done. Because I know that there are certain things, mother's work and this work that God has given to me, that if they are not accomplished when the time comes that I draw this last breath, I will not be satisfied. I don't know about God and the Masters, but I definitely will not be satisfied, nor do I think they will be. I have been given tasks to do, and I must accomplish them, and I will accomplish them. Will you? Will you? You know, sometimes your tasks, sometimes we think, well, you have to write a great book or start a huge movement or be something in the public light or do something grand in order to fulfill the purpose for which you have come. But many times this is not it. It is living the ordinary life, but doing it in an extraordinary way. Krishna one time described the one who had gone the whole way as lost in the common life. And that doesn't mean that you are lost spiritually in the common life, but that your life can look the same as anyone else's. Even in Krishna, in his life as royalty, he was not seen as extraordinary by many people that were around him. For many years, Lari Mahasaya's own wife had no knowledge of the spiritual heights that he had attained. Sometimes when people came to Anandashram, people would complain about Papa, about Mataji. What they were expecting, I don't know. But Papa would say, what, are we supposed to be wearing horns? Is there supposed to be something so extraordinary about us that people will immediately begin to acknowledge the spiritual greatness? When Jesus was needed to be identified in the Garden of Gethsemane, they had Judas come to do it. Because why? Did he stand out so much differently than his disciples? No. He was, from an outward standpoint, he was an ordinary human being. We have to get over this notion that this Christ is going to return from the clouds and it's going to be just so extraordinary that everybody will fall down in worship. We have to find God first within ourselves, within the ordinary. And then you find the extraordinary spread all through the ordinary. Every flower will take on a remarkable experience of God. Every person, you will find God within that person. If God asks me to give a talk and there is but one person listening to that talk, that person is infinite. Therefore, I am giving a talk to the infinite. And it is extraordinary. Not because of anything of the humanness in me, it is because God is giving to God. And that's what makes it extraordinary. You may give someone a smile. You may give someone a helping hand. You may send someone a prayer of encouragement and light and life and health. And you are God's agent. You are doing something extraordinary in the ordinary. And this is what we have come to do, you see. Pay attention to the little things. And the big things generally take care of themselves. Make God your partner, part and parcel of every part of your life, every element of it. And you will have a life so fulfilling, so great, so blissful, that you will fulfill the promise made by Master here, that this gaining of bliss, he's right to say that bliss is not the opposite of pain in a strict sense. Pleasure is the opposite of pain. But bliss takes you beyond, and you can have bliss even when you are in pain. Because bliss has no opposite. There is no situation, there is no occasion in which bliss cannot be there. So fulfill this true reason for why you have come. and find your oneness with God every day, every moment, every second. And you will never look back with regret on anything that you may have left behind because it just didn't fit into God's plans. That's all right. Because God, who is infinite, is with you. And whatever it is that you need, He will fulfill that in the moment that it is needed. So let us sit in quiet receptivity and receive what God is giving to you in this moment. The pranic life energy flowing to you. Perfect health flowing to you. It's all in the pipeline. Prosperity and material goods that are needed flowing to you. Creative ideas flowing to you. Expansiveness of spirit and attunement with God flowing to you is with you. Love flowing in and through your heart. The love that surpasses all understanding. So great is it. So pure. So without personal motive. That love flows to fulfill itself within itself. Do you see what treasures you have? Your treasures in heaven are here and now. I bow to God within you.